And I said, okay, so this house is great, but on your left and your right, those two big, beautiful vacant lots are buildable lots, and they're owned by a bank. So who knows who they're going to sell it to and what amount they're going to sell it for, and it could be a fire sale, so you get somebody buying a lot that can't really afford to build a house of the same quality of your house. You know, if we knew it was a high-priced lot that was going to go to somebody, but we don't know. We don't know what's going to be built there, and it's going to be right there. I said, and the problem's going to be, it's going to be 16 months on the left side and then 2 months of quiet, and then they're going to go build on the other side. And there's another 16 okay. months, you know. So you
instantly gained his trust there.
Yeah. And I was not doing it for any other purpose than because I was just doing my job.
Welcome to the Top Broker Podcast, where we have on top producing real estate agents from around the country and learn what separates them from the rest. I'm your host, Phil Wells. Today we have on Malone Hodges from the Carmel Realty Company. Let's get right into it. Malone Hodges was the founding broker of Carmel Realty Company, the luxury market leader in Carmel by the Sea. He has served as the president of the Monterey County Association of Realtors and is a certified instructor for the California Association of Realtors. Malone, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here. Great to finally get to meet you in person instead of over email.
Absolutely. So can you tell us a little bit about your business in general there in Carmel by the Sea?
Sure. So we like to talk about the Monterey Peninsula, which is the cities of Carmel by the Sea, the surrounding area known as Carmel, Pebble Beach, Monterey, Pacific Grove. It's all the places that you want to be if you're in the Central Coast. I've been doing residential real estate here for a couple of decades now. It's primarily luxury homes. A lot of them are second homes. We draw from the tech industry up in Silicon Valley. We draw from Texas, Chicago, New York, places that people want to escape for a little while and come here to the Monterey Coast. It's an interesting market in that we have, I don't want to call them micro markets, but you can go an eighth of a mile or a quarter mile and you can see a 20 or 30% swing in property values. It's very, you know, it's very, very tight. Like the city of Carmel by the Sea is only 1 square mile, and it has four sections that we define as real estate brokers. So in 1 square mile, and the value of properties in each of those four is radically different as a function of proximity to downtown and to the ocean and some other factors. And then it's surrounded by an area of the county that's called Carmel, and that also has huge variability. The Carmel Point, which is to the southern end of town, like I have a $4.3 million listing there that's about 2,100 square feet. A house of similar size on the other side in the county, on the other side would be 2.5, right? Wow. So a mile away. So it's pretty dramatic.
Yeah, so going from like 1,000 a foot to 2,000 a foot.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Then you get this variability in what buyers are looking for. Like, do I want a 1,600 square foot cottage in Carmel by the Sea where I can have a glass of wine and walk 4 blocks to home and then tomorrow morning get up and take my dog on the walk on the beach, which is 4 blocks away in a different direction, but it's 1,600 square feet, right? I had a client from Texas I was showing around one time, and I won't do the Texas accent and embarrass myself, but we're in this house that's about, it's probably 1,800 to 2,000 square feet. And he said to me, he said, Malone, my garage in Houston is twice the size of this house. And we'll just call him Chuck. And I said, well, that's true, Chuck. But right now, what's the temperature in Houston? And what's the humidity? And look at the view. And he's like, okay, all fair points, right? So, but it does take a lot of folks have to recalibrate their expectation in our market because in Carmel by the Sea, the houses are typically 1,600 square feet with a one-car garage. And a lot of them are second homes. So these are people that have a primary residence up in Atherton, or we have a huge population from Texas. I'm a pilot, and Monterey Airport here has a fairly active private jet traffic that comes in for golf and everything. And a huge percentage of the jets that fly into Monterey originate in Houston and Dallas-Fort Worth. So we have a big Texas population.
So there's a big corridor between Texas and sort of like in New York, we have like Florida to New York. Yeah. It's kind of a similar corridor, you think?
Yeah, very much so. I have a colleague of mine who has a huge portfolio of clients that she's become very close friends with who are all Texans. And, you know, somebody, and this isn't true just of Texas, but somebody will move here and then they'll invite their friends for a weekend and their friends are like, this is fantastic. Why don't we have a house here? And then it just, it just multiplies from there.
That's really interesting. We have someone on our team from Texas, and he flies out. He has his license there. He flies out to Texas, does a $2 or $3 million deal, flies back.
Wow.
You know, and it's pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
Malone, can you tell us your theory on work-life balance? I know that you've managed a lot of agents before, and just curious what your thoughts are there.
Yeah. So here, this, and I don't, so this is a classic case of practice what I preach, not what I do. So I ran an ag biotech company years ago, and I had an attorney who was an intellectual property attorney. He was, you know, worked really hard, but I didn't have kids yet or anything. And his name is Chuck. And I said, Chuck, how in the heck do you do this? Because he's like us, right? It was the respond anytime. And he said, the secret is to treat your family as one of your best clients. Not necessarily your best client, but in that top list of clients. Because let's say that I on Saturday am going to go camping with my wife. If a client calls, before I even think about it, I say, of course I can show you around on Saturday because I've already figured out in my head I can move time with my wife to Sunday, right? And Chuck's point was, but if on Saturday you were showing around a guy who you sold a $12 million property to, who's become a good friend and he's got a friend in town and they want to go look at properties, you probably wouldn't bump that guy for whoever this other person is. You would say, I'm sorry, I'm not available on Saturday, but I can do Sunday. He said, that's the way to manage it. And his example was a good one. He got a call. There was some big presentation that needed to happen. And the client called and said, I need you here at 4 o'clock this afternoon. And we're going to work until we get this done. And Chuck's like, I can't. I'm sorry. I already have a commitment elsewhere. And it was a commitment to his son's baseball, 9-year-old Little League. But he didn't say that. He said, I'm sorry. I'm already committed with another client this evening. I can't do it. The guy said, well, if you can't do it, that's ridiculous. And Chuck said, no, I can do it. Here's what we're going to do. I'll be at your office at 6 a.m. I'm going to bring 2 paralegals. I'll bring coffee and donuts. We'll have you ready for your meeting by 10:30 or 11. No problem. You know, if we start at 6, we only need an hour and a half. I'll have breakfast laid out. We can do it at your office. He just solved the problem right away. And there's this long pause. And the guy goes, yeah, let me just see if I can move the 10 o'clock to Monday of next week. Right? So Chuck delivered on the requirement of the client, but protected his son's baseball game. And then the client was the one that said to himself, I don't want to be here at 6 a.m.
Sure.
And then he was able to move the meeting. But to me, the way you hold on to some control over your own life is to remember that your family or that vacation or your son's baseball game or your daughter's ballet, they are one of your best clients. So yeah, maybe you miss the baseball game because your number one highest producing client is in town only for 2 days and you have no choice. But you always think of them as being in that top bucket of clients.
So I think that's fantastic.
That's the way to do it. So, I mean, there you go.
No, I love that because it, you always feel like if you say no, that you're giving something up, you know?
Yeah.
And even there was a time in my career when I said, because in New York, it's a city of renters. So we have, 70% of people rent here.
Wow.
So you're dealing with a lot of requests to help so-and-so with a rental. And we do collect, significant fees from doing rentals. But there's a big difference between like the rental broker and the sales broker.
Got it.
So, you do typically make, 5 to 10 times on a sale what you would make on a rental. But the rentals, the sales process here takes a long time. So you might be in contract. It might take 6 months for something to close, and the whole process can take a while. And so with a rental, you get paid right away. And so there's this sort of a lot of people sort of stuck in that hand to mouth working on the rental game. And so there was a time in my career when I said, I'm not going to do rentals unless they're above a certain price point, just because I got to set a bar. And I've been running around with too many people doing too many things, and I'm saying yes too often. And the minute I did that, the bigger sales started coming in and everything just kind of got elevated. And all of a sudden I was in a different tier. And it was really from me saying no more often that better opportunities started coming. And ultimately I was happier. I was spending more time with the higher end clients that I wanted to. And my work-life balance did improve too.
Yeah.
So sometimes saying no isn't always a bad thing. If maybe that guy who wanted the 10 a.m. meeting, or, he really wanted stuff delivered right away. Maybe he was just a difficult client that maybe you want to say no to.
Yeah. And sometimes I think you can project onto your client a sense of urgency that may not be valid. In other words, hey, can I see this property on Saturday morning at 9? And then you wreck your entire weekend to accomplish that. And had you said to him or her, you know, 9 isn't a great for me. Is there any chance we could do it 2 in the afternoon? They're like, yeah, I don't care. 2's fine. But you never brought that up. So you warp everything around. Now, they might say, no, 2 doesn't work. 9 is the only time I have. Okay, well, then maybe that's where you start the process of, you know, validating that that's what you should go do. But I think as an industry, we tend to hesitate to say, that doesn't work. Could we do this instead? Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's a learned skill, as is saying no. I mean, all of us wake up at 2 a.m. thinking about the list of things we haven't done. Right. So anyway, there's a bunch of that. In fact, there is a Ralph Waldo Emerson quote on my wall. Hold on. He said, write it on your heart that every day is the best day in the year. He is rich who owns the day, and no one owns the day who allows it to be invaded with fret and anxiety. Finish every day and be done with it. You have done what you could. Some blunders and absurdities no doubt crept in. Forget them as soon as you can. Tomorrow is a new day. Begin it well and serenely, with too high a spirit to be cumbered with your old nonsense. This new day is too dear, with its hopes and invitations, to waste a moment on the yesterdays. It's pretty good, right?
That's really good.
Isn't that good?
Really good.
So here's another one. And it says, I'm worried, said Tiny Dragon. I don't know what to do next. For just a moment, said Big Panda, stop, breathe, and listen to the wind in the bamboo. Right? Because I think real estate, people like the real estate brokers, right? They want us to be a source of knowledge and information, but also just calmness in the waters. Mm-hmm. And if you're completely stressed out about the falling market and the drop in inventory and all of that, first of all, it messes with you, but I don't think it helps you in pursuing business, right? I really think people pick up on that. You know, I think it feels good to tell a client that I don't think we should go up. I think this, you know, we talked about, I often say that when the market was really hot and we were buyers, we go look at a house and let's say it was listed at $2 million. And I'd say, okay, it's got the bedrooms you want, but not the view. It's this, that, and the other thing. So what do we think this house is worth to you? And we'd go through the numbers and they'd say, okay, it's worth 2.2. I'd say, okay, I'm going to write that down. I wrote down 2.2 million. I said, that I'm not going to hold you to that. But right now, before we write our offer, we've agreed that based on the data you have at hand, it's worth 2.2. So then we make it's 10 offers, and then we get multiple countered. And, you know, pretty soon we're at 2.2. And we got to counter them back. And one of the two, you know, clients says, okay, let's go to $2,350,000. And I say, okay. You remember when we decided last week it was worth 2.2? It's now my job to tell you that we are $150,000 over that.
Right.
I am totally okay with that. And I make a joke about, you know, I only get paid when you buy a house, right?
Right.
But I also live in this community and I genuinely want to be your ally and friend going forward. I don't want to close a deal and then, you know, the next day you never want to talk to me. So why are we going to 2,350? Are we going to 2,350 only because somebody else paid 2,300? Because last week it was 2,200. And it's okay to not compete to win if when we win, we aren't happy that we won. And I had a client, did that whole spiel, and he's like, how in the hell do you make a living? Because you keep talking us out of buying these things. I said, eventually it will happen. Just you know, we're going to find the right one. But I think if you're desperate on your own behalf with all of the legitimate reasons to be desperate, then they can't trust that you're going to be that fiduciary and that advisor. And I think that comes out in a, you know, subconsciously.
It definitely does. I had clients yesterday say the first property I saw with them, the whole time walking through it, I was pointing out problems and I was, they seemed to like it. They're like, oh, we kind of like, and I was like, guys, just so you know, this and this and this and this. And I was like, all right, we went to the basement and nothing was to code. I mean, it was just like the boiler was like a fire, total fire hazard. And then as they walked above, it was a busy open house. There was a lot of people walking the house. I said, look at it sag. Look at this place. There's like, there's no way you're buying this.
Yeah.
And then they told me today, and this is, you know, 12 houses later, we're doing an inspection on a property that they're about to sign the contract for. And they said, you know, we decided that we were working with you after the first property when you were pointing out all those problems and you didn't want to sell it. Like, you were just like, no, you're not buying this. And the fact that I had such a strong, you know, just, well, look, you're not buying it. Like, I made this appointment for you. It's the only one we're seeing all day, but you're not buying this house.
It's not happening.
And a lot of trust was, you know, was gained there. And to your point of, you know, kind of being that, the cool waters. I think the idea is that if they're picking up on kind of like nervous energy from you, then what's wrong? Is something wrong here? You know, it's not that you need to project, you know, strength and you know, you just need to be yourself and you need to just be, it's hard to explain exactly what it is,
I agree with you. I think one of the, it's a really, and of course, I should come visit you in New York and see how different it is, because clearly there's a lot of commonalities. But one of the things I teach when you join the local association of realtors, you go through a contract class, which is a whole day class that we make everybody take. Even if they're like, if you moved here from New York and you worked in LA for 2 years and then you moved up to Monterey, when you joined our association, you have to sit through this contract class that I teach. And one of the things when I teach the class is I say, there's sort of three ways I teach this. I'm going to teach you the rules within the four corners of the contract, what the words mean, how you're going to get stuck, how to defend your client. Then I'm going to talk about the strategies you can use, like why would you counter like this or do that, and why is it important the number of days and the contingent, all this kind of stuff. And the third is just examples and insights on how to be a successful real estate broker and a fiduciary to your clients. And one of the things I say in that third part is be yourself. Like, don't model yourself on me. I mean, sure, capture the insights I give you about the contract, but don't try and be me. Be yourself, because your clients can tell. Like, I come across as a fairly energetic, maybe drank too much caffeine, even though I only have one cup a day, kind of guy. I talk fairly quickly. I like to laugh. Well, I'm not a perfect match for every client, right? I have a very successful colleague, and I'm 56. She's probably in her late 70s. Very great sense of humor, but very calm, very, you know, thoughtful. And we have a great time together, but it's like yin and yang, right? Mm-hmm. So she might be a better match for a client, but I don't try and be her and she doesn't try and be me. And boy, a lot of people get into real estate and they think they see somebody on YouTube and they think, I got to go be like that person. And I think that just sets you up for failure because you're not genuine. That was way too long an answer to that. But I think being genuine is the core point to that. Mm-hmm. Like, do you play golf?
I don't, no.
Yeah, me neither. And I live in Carmel and Pebble Beach, right? Mm-hmm. I'm in the golfing mecca and I don't play golf. So when I first moved here 20 some odd years ago, I took a few golf lessons. It's actually a really fun sport. I was like, oh, this is fun. But I have two small kids and no source of income. I can't go learn how to play golf at the level of these other people, even though everybody's like, you need to play golf to be a successful real estate agent, right?
Sure.
So the way I built my business initially is I would meet with you as a client and I'd say, hey, nice to meet you. You know, I'd love to represent you in the sale of your home. A couple things I'd like to let you know is I used to run an ag biotech company and I had professionals that worked for me, and that's how I'm going to work for you as a professional. I have a great wife. I got these two great kids. You may never meet them. I'm not going to walk up to you at the club because I'm not a member of your club. I'm not going to walk up to you on the golf course. You're hiring me like a cardiologist or an attorney. You're not hiring me because I'm in your golf foursome, because I don't play golf. So when the other realtors are out playing golf and doing that, I'm actually out trying to sell your house, right? So I used my not playing golf as a way to differentiate myself from a lot of my colleagues who play golf.
Yeah. And how do you, so you're still associated with
Carmel Realty Company. Yep.
Carmel Realty Company, who is pretty dominant in that area. Can you talk a little bit about Carmel Realty Company?
Yeah. So the history is sort of interesting. We're one of the four companies that have been part of the Carmel Chamber of Commerce for more than 100 years. So it's been around since, Carmel Realty has been around since 1913. And it did property management and sales for many of those years. And then there was a period where it was primarily just doing property management. Then in 07 or 08, a group of us moved from a large national brand to Carmel Realty. And there were four or five of us in this little beat up office with green carpet and I had a trash can on my desk because the roof leaked in when it rained. And we restarted Carmel Realty as both property management, but also sales. And so we're now between, and we have another brand called Monterey Coast Realty. So between those two brands, we're pretty much dominant at the high end luxury real estate in our area. We're still locally owned by a family, and there's about 80 agents. And I was the founding managing broker. So it was four of us, and I took on the task of being one of the brokers to put it together. It was fantastic. Mm-hmm. Good fun.
And to fix the leaking roof.
Yeah. I'll send you a picture of what the office looks like now. I don't think we've talked about this over the years, that we really wish we had some pictures of us back then. I mean, it was green carpet. And now, of course, it's wood and it's polished and it's very professional looking. But yeah, but it was fun crawling through the old boxes and finding old signs. And, we have this old Carmel Realty sign from, the 1920s or 30s and stuff. So it has a lot of history on the peninsula.
So when you, they dealt a lot with property management. Are a lot of those vacation rentals? How does the vacation rental market work in Carmel by the Sea?
Yeah. Did you know... So a friend of mine, a guy named Jim Winterbotham, who was my first mentor, was doing some stuff at Carmel Realty and doing property management. And he said to me, do you know how to tell the difference between a property management agent and a sales agent? I said, no, Jim, I don't know. And this is back when phones had cords, right? And he said, so you grab the phone and you send it in the middle of the conference room. I'm like, okay. He said, then you have somebody call it. Soon as the phone rings, all the property management agent starts to twitch and move away from the phone. And all of the sales agents dive for the phone to try and grab it and see if it's a lead. He said, that's the difference. And I said, and I'm not going to do property management. So it is definitely a skill to be able to manage these properties and, you know, the tenants and the landlords and fix all the toilets. And, you know, we all deal with property problems. But when you're managing it as a vacation rental or long-term rental, it's a serious challenge. So we have a few companies that, and we're the dominant luxury brand. When you rent in Carmel by the Sea, the local code requires you to rent for no less than a month. So it's a lot of folks, many from New York, Chicago, LA, a lot from Texas, who will decamp here for a month or two of the year. And then they can be in the county areas and in Pebble Beach for a week or so. The rules change a little bit depending on what city you're in. But it is definitely a vacation rental destination. There are some vacation properties that have actually sold multiple times and the tenants are still coming for the same week or month that they've come for 20 years, right? So instead of having a house in the Hamptons, you always go back and rent the same house in the Hamptons would be the analogy. So there's a lot of that here.
And a lot of those houses in the Hamptons, a lot of their value is in the summer months, right? So like, how does it work though? Because you have a little bit more consistent weather over there. Is it?
Yeah, we do. So it's a little bit more year round here than I would think it would be in the Hamptons. There are a couple of big months, like February, we have the AT&T golf tournament, and that is that's a very big month. In August, we have the Pebble Beach Concours d'Elegance, which is a huge car show. The best weather here is in the spring and fall. So a lot of folks will come for the summer and have a wonderful time, but it can be foggy here. It's a relative, and that's why a lot of folks come from Texas, because it's not 110. And then in September and October, it's just gorgeous. So we have a year-round vacation rental market, but it definitely has peaks around these big social events, mainly the car show and the golf tournaments.
So a lot of the brokers that you mentioned, so when you were... the managing broker for Carmel Realty Company. Yep. Do a lot of the new brokers, do they focus on the vacation rental market or not as much?
No, it's a very, so our overlap, like what you're talking about, where you do the rentals and the sales, mm-hmm. that's not the model here. Typically, if you're a property management agent, there's a couple of exceptions, but that's what you focus on. And if you're a sales agent, you do sales. So for instance, if I, like say you said to me, hey, I'd love to rent a house here for a couple of months, I would connect you with the vacation rental managers and say, hey, these people are going to come show you some properties. The other interesting thing to note is that the MLS here covers properties for sale, but there's not really an equivalent MLS for rentals. It exists, but nobody really uses it. So if you talk to company A and look at their 15 homes and don't like them, they don't even know, nor would they necessarily point you to company B to go look at the 12 that they have. You know, they might, if you've looked at all of their 15 and you say, none of these work. You know, there's definitely a level of courtesy to say, well, let me see what I can do. Let me connect you with somebody at another company. But they don't know each other's inventory.
Sure. And I imagine you're paid on the landlord side. You're not paid on the tenant side.
So it depends. Yeah. Usually what happens is the deal for a rental is a percentage of, if it's a vacation rent, it's just a percentage of whatever the rental rate is. And the rental companies here, like Carmel Realty's, very well known for helping. The houses have to be well put together, right? So if you bought a house here that was vacant and said, okay, I want to put this in the rental inventory, you would work with the property managers at Carmel Realty, and they'd say, okay, you need an espresso machine, you need this many sets of sheets, it should be this thread count. You know, there's a level of expectation of what the tenant is going to find when they get here. They also have an estate management program, which is also maybe true in places like the Hamptons, where they will go check on your house every week or every 2 weeks and flush all the toilets, check all the lights, water all the plants, do all that. And then you call up and say, hey, I'm landing at the FBO, Tuesday. I got 6 people coming over for dinner. Could you please stock the fridge? And I want, you know, this is what I want. And you show up, arrive at your house, and the fridge is stocked. The flowers are on the table, you know, the whole deal.
Wow. No, that is more service than I've ever heard before.
Yeah.
It sounds like chartering a yacht or something.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Actually, you know what? That's not a bad analogy. It is a little bit like that. And they'll arrange, like, our team at Carmel Realty throws birthday parties and weddings and, you know, anything. You pretty much can call them up and say, oh, a lot of corporate stuff. A lot of companies, you know, we're very close to Silicon Valley. So a lot of tech companies, maybe not so much this month, but when they, you know, a lot of tech companies will have events down here and they'll be in private residences with their board or whatever.
Sure. A question I've been dying to ask you. In your annual report, you mentioned 45% of your sales were off market. How do you source so many off market deals?
Yeah, that's a good question. Our market is interesting in that, first of all, I'm a firm believer in the MLS. I will tell a person going to sell their property, look, we have a Tesla dealership that opened here, and it opened next to Jaguar and across the street from Rolls-Royce because it wants to go where the car buyers are going, right? It didn't open 20 miles away by itself because it wants to catch the people headed to Jaguar who might slide in and take a look at a Tesla. And the MLS is the equivalent to that, right? You put a property on the MLS, we get calls from buyers in Hong Kong because they've seen it on our MLS. Having said that, we are a market where there are a number of sellers who would prefer not to have that public exposure. I had a meeting yesterday on a property that's about $3.5 million. We are going to go on the MLS, but we're not going to do any open houses. It's appointment only, pre-qualified buyers, and no sign on the property, right? So the next step from that is, no, I don't want to be on the MLS. So that puts us in a situation where we have to work our networks with other brokers, our own networks, the networks within our company. So let's say that you had a $6 million property, and for whatever reason that's up to you, you don't want it on the MLS. We would do the photography and do a video and all that, and then we would network in our community to try and get the word out to try and find you a buyer. We have such limited inventory, even in a hot market, there's just not a lot of properties here, right? So pretty much all the successful brokers here have a list of buyers who have said to me, hey, if you can find me this, I would like to see it and I would probably buy it, right? Mm-hmm. So I was on a broker's tour a couple days ago and corralled a colleague of mine and gave her a rundown on what I have a client that's looking for. And she said, well, have you talked to so-and-so? And I said, no, but that's a great idea, right? So there's a lot of that, I would say, positive camaraderie of trying to solve problems for our clients. I gather that is not a universal trait across all real estate markets. I think part of it is we're so small and we have to work so closely together. This is independent of company, right? There's this collaborative nature to how we all work here. But like I have colleagues in LA and I don't know about New York, but they laugh at me when I tell them that kind of story because that's not how it is there.
No, I'll tell you that yesterday I sent a bunch of emails out. I have a client who's looking for a specific building. You know, we have these new development buildings that go up 200 units. Some of them take some 5 years to sell it and they just linger on the market. Some of them sell out almost immediately. Yeah. And this one was one of the more popular buildings that sold out almost immediately. And so I was emailing brokers who I know have done deals in the building. They haven't even closed yet. They're held in contract until. Wow. And I'm saying, is there anyone who would do a contract flip? I have clients for a 3 and 4 bedroom, you know, and they're really interested in it. And it's the sort of thing where, you know, there is a handful of brokers that there's probably 10% of the brokers do 90% of the business here. So it's very lopsided, but it means that, you know, we'll throw parties and just for the brokers to come and see stuff. We have a really good group of folks, you know, and it's great. Like, we really do work together so much. Yep. There's a lot of that. So
good. I'm really happy to hear that. Cause I think I always come back to what's our fiduciary duty, right? Who are we trying to serve? And that's our clients. And that's a much better way for it to be done. In that class I mentioned, one of the things I talk about is real estate is this really interesting profession where, let's say you and I are both going on a listing presentation in competition with each other. And maybe we know we're competing with each other because I see your car parked out. This has happened to me. I pulled up to a house, and as I'm walking in, a colleague is walking. I'm like, hey, how are you? Nice, good. Who's next? Oh, I think so-and-so's after you. Okay, great. Right? So, you know, we're in competition to get the listing, right? And then one of us gets it. So let's say you get it and I don't. So I get a call. Ideally, the client has the courtesy to call me and say, I didn't get it. And I solicit feedback. And I say, well, thank you very much. I think you did a... You picked the second best option. I think I would have been the best, but I think you did a good job with who you picked. I just say you did it. That's fine. I'm sure he'll do a great job for you. I'm going to stop talking to you now about your house because now that you've listed it, it's most appropriate for me to talk to, you know, whomever it was. Let's say it's you, to Phil. So I'm going to give him a call if that's okay with you because I want to make sure I get my clients in there, you know, as soon as possible. And the client says, oh, that would be wonderful, because there's nothing more effective than showing up with a buyer on a house that you missed on the listing, because it sort of reemphasizes the point that you were going to get the job done for him. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so we're sort of in conflict. Then you get the listing and I write an offer, and let's say it's a little bit of a pain, right? I have a buyer who's a little persnickety and a little demanding, and your seller's demanding. It's only been on 6 days and my guy wants the jacuzzi, and you're like, why the hell should you get the jacuzzi? And we're back and forth, and I feel like your guy isn't being reasonable and you don't think I'm being reasonable. So we're, you know, and it's what we're doing, what we're supposed to do, which is we're negotiating hard. Then we get into escrow. That moment in time, the buyer and seller are 100% aligned. They have both signed a contract that says the exact same thing, and they've handed it to you and me and said, we both want you to go do this. The second that happens, I need to take a deep breath and forget the fact that I thought you took advantage of me and got the jacuzzi when my guy should have had it, right? Or I wanted the closing date that you wouldn't give us because I know your person is just being a schmuck and it really screwed up my client's schedule, right? I have to let all that go because the buyer and seller have told the two of us, we, the buyer and seller aligned, you two go make this happen. That is a learned skill, right? And those of us who are good at that, and I can pick up the phone the next day and say, okay, we're in. Listen, I got to get my inspector in. What are we going to do about the roof? You know, that was a big issue for my guy. And they're like, yeah, I think I got a solution to that. Boom, boom, boom. Now we're perfectly aligned again, right? And yet, on that same day, I might have just gotten a listing that you were competing with me against, and I have to be able to compartmentalize that as well. Or maybe we're in the midst of I was on a phone with a colleague of mine, and we were going at it about this deal. And if somebody had walked by my parked car, they would have thought I was fighting with somebody. Maybe. And he was definitely on the other end. And we hang up the phone, and 10 minutes later, the phone rings and it's him again. I pick it up. I'm like, yes. And he goes, hey, can I show that house on Lower Trail on Tuesday? And I'm like, yeah, that'd be great. Tuesday, no problem. Right. Because it's different topic. Right. And I think that's part of what makes the job fun too, though. Right. Is that while, I mean, we've both been doing this a while, every deal is different, and being able to bring that skill set on behalf of your client to the table to negotiate that deal, but then also keep it together. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, let me ask you this. The houses there. So if you're can you tell me about the different neighborhoods, the different associations? Are there historic districts? You know, if I want to paint my house pink, you know, can I? Tell me about that a little bit.
So we really don't have historic districts as much as we have specific historic homes, both in Carmel by the Sea, in Pacific Grove, Monterey. These are the cities here on the Monterey Peninsula and in the areas of the county. So if a home is deemed historic, you're constrained about what you can do to the exterior of the house. And it can be historic for, there's actually four different reasons, but the most obvious ones are it was by an architect who's famous, or it's representative of a certain style. So if you picture a cute Carmel cottage, let's say it was built in the 1920s by a builder named Murphy, it may be historic if it looks and still is the original house. If in 1972 somebody added a bedroom and expanded the kitchen, it's no longer historic. And the constraints are paint, changing the structure. It doesn't mean you can't ever add to a historic home, which is sort of wild. So if you, let's say you have a little 800 square foot cottage, what they really care about is what it looks like from the street. Okay, so sure. You say, okay, the front of the house is going to look like this little 800 square foot cottage, but I'd like to add 1,000 feet in the back with two more bedrooms. You can work with the city and they'll say, okay, you can do that. And a lot of people think what the city's going to want is they're going to want it to look exactly like the front, right? That's not what they want. The goal is that if a person skilled in the art walked up to the house 50 years from now without plans, they could tell where the original cottage ended and the new addition started. So like the front will be board and bat, let's say that's 8 inches wide, and the back will be 4 inch wide. So it'll look similar, but you can clearly say, aha, this is where the addition was made. And we have a lot of historic homes in Carmel, and we have very significant constraints on any houses in Carmel. Square footage, and we have something called volumetrics.
Okay.
Are you ready? Yeah. Do you have that?
We have a floor area ratio.
Okay, so we have that too.
FAR. Okay, all right. Give me a volumetric.
Okay, so volumetrics is the volume that the house takes up. So you literally take the plans of the house and you fill it with, you know, like meter by meter cubes and triangles, and you say, okay, this house has X cubic feet of volume in it. And that's a limited number. So I can walk you into a house and we'll walk in and you'd say, God, I wish the architect had just, why isn't the roof just a little bit more, you know, just a little? I guess it's a podcast. So we walk into a house and you might look at a ceiling and you're like, why is the peak of the ceiling only 14 feet? It would be so much better if it was 16. Right. And if the architect's with you, they start to turn red and steam comes out of their ears because they agree, but they couldn't do that because they didn't have enough volume. Okay. And part of the reason was cities in Southern California, like Manhattan Beach and elsewhere, have floor area ratio requirements and square footage and stuff. So what people would do is they basically make boxes, right? Just rectangles. So we don't want that. So the way to do that is to force people to adjust based on volume. And we don't want alleyway shotguns between the houses. So the house has to bump out or bump in with a certain number of, within a certain number of feet. So you don't walk, you know, you just don't see these alleyways between the houses. The chimney has to bump out or living room has to bump in. We have a lot. We have a very intense planning and design review process.
That makes sense. I mean, because you see, there's some neighborhoods like in Brooklyn where you have fully detached houses, a 3,000 square foot house on a 40 by 100 foot lot. So you have what they often do is, I'm selling one right now, 3,500 square feet. It's actually a really cute. The way they did it is actually they're sort of Victorian and they're very kind of cute. What they do is they do stained glass windows on the side, and you have almost no side yard. So I'll send you a listing of this.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. And there's some old historic neighborhoods like Ditmas Park is a good example. And beautiful old trees that, you know, the trees come together like this at the top, you know, it's just beautiful. But it's a different style and I can see the weakness of that. You know, if you fly into New York, you'll see a lot of houses to begin with fully detached. Then you see semi-attached where they're duplex, kind of like duplex side by side.
Right.
And then you see the row houses start, you know, in Brooklyn, just da, 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 da. It's just interesting. I wanted to ask you about the lot sizes, like lot sizes versus square footage of these houses.
So in Carmel by the Sea, so Carmel by the Sea is an actual city and they're 40 by 100. And I'll send you the map. But if you look at the map of Carmel by the Sea, clearly some guy on a draftsman's table in the early 1900s just went line, 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 and didn't pay a lot of attention to topography, right? There's a few concessions to where we've got some topography, but it's 40 by 100 up and down all these hills. So most houses are on a 40 by 100 and they're 1600 square feet plus a 200 square foot garage. Now, there are some houses that are larger than that, so they're legal non-conforming because they were built. So they used to be small because that's what people built. And then for a while they got bigger because people wanted to build bigger. And then now they're constrained to small. So there are a few that are larger, more like what you're talking about, like really fill the lot. So if you were to buy one of those houses, you can't tear it down and rebuild that house. So there's a lot more remodeling that goes on here than bulldoze and start over. Right. Because in most cases, the existing structure offers you something of value. It's in the setback, or it's bigger square footage, or it's more volume, or it's closer to the front. So almost always it's remodeled. Occasionally, I owned a little 800 square foot house that was on a double lot, and I actually tore it down, but it was sat on the lot line. So I built two houses, so I took it out. But that's not as common as remodeling.
If you have a double lot, can you build a 3,200 square foot house or not really?
Yep, you can. Yep, there. If you combine the two lots, so this was two legal lots of record. If you combine the two lots, you can build a bigger house. And we have a couple of lots that are actually quite large that are a series of lots that were combined, you know, quite some time ago.
And is there a benefit if you owned, I guess, is the whole greater than the sum of the parts? Like, is it worth more? Is one 3,200 square foot house worth more than double two 1,600 square foot houses?
Most of the time, the answer to that is yes, because it's that unique product out there, right? So you don't even have to go to double. If you can get to 2,300, because maybe you're on a lot and a half, or it's existing, it's legal non-conforming, you're differentiating yourself from everything else that's 16 plus 200, right? So there is a demand for a larger home in Carmel by the Sea. But if you really want a big house, you end up either in the county or you end up in Pebble Beach. I mean, Pebble Beach has huge variability in lot size, you know, from relatively small to acre and a half, 2 acres, and estates that go from, you know, coastal estate in the tens of millions of dollars to a small house on a small lot that might be $1.2 million on the far end of Pebble Beach.
Okay. Yeah.
I had a client years ago, and we were looking at houses in Pebble Beach, and I said, well, you know, there's a great house that is actually less dollars per square foot, but it's just, and it's right over there in Pacific Grove. So it's just outside of Pebble Beach. And he's like, no, I want to be in Pebble Beach. And I said, okay, well, that's fine. But, you know, the quality of life, I mean, it's literally right there. You know, either you can walk from here to there and da, 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 da. He goes, yeah. Really nice guy. He's like, you don't understand. Where was he coming from? Kansas? So he says to me, I don't really understand. I'm moving here from St. Louis or Kansas somewhere. This is a lot of years ago. And I want to live in Pebble Beach because I want everybody to know where I left, that I made it and I moved to Pebble Beach. Sure. And that's where I want my address to be. And I started opening my mouth. I said, I know what you're going to say. They're never going to come visit. It doesn't matter how small. I would rather have the worst house in Pebble Beach for the address than a better house in Pacific Grove, because I need these guys to know that I moved to Pebble Beach. I was like, okay, we'll put that right up on the top of the criteria list. So he bought a house in Pebble Beach.
It's nice that he was honest about it, you know?
Totally. And a great sense of humor. And he lived there. He may still be in it, actually. A lot of people's dream is to come here, live here, play golf here, spend time here. I mean, we are definitely... It's hard to complain about anything when you live here, because we all sort of check each other. Like, yeah, really? It's not that bad living on the Monterey Peninsula.
Yeah, it seems like a pretty nice place.
It is.
I've been to Monterey, but I've never been down there. So I'd love to go.
Oh yeah, you should come. You should come. I think on my YouTube, do I say that on the video? I say something about nobody ever has to move here, right? You know, no company says, oh, I'm going to relocate. We don't have a relocation office, right? Whereas, you know, I might get hired and somebody sends me to Manhattan, right? Or Brooklyn or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
You know, somewhere. No company says, you, we want you to move to Pebble Beach.
Sure. You make that decision yourself.
Yeah. You try and convince them to pay to have you move here, but it's,
Let me see if I have any. I think you'll enjoy this one. What is your most unconventional piece of real estate advice that you'd give to newer agents?
Unconventional. So I guess one of the things that I would say to a new agent, again, this is the practice what you preach thing, but one of the things I would say to a new agent is you're gonna, whenever you tell somebody you're a real estate agent, they're gonna engage you in a conversation about properties. Like, hey, well, have you seen the one on Ocean View Avenue? As a new agent, you should always go on tour. So we have every Tuesday is a tour in one area. Every Wednesday is a different area. Every Thursday, it's like, you know, commit to go do that because you're going to see the inventory and you're going to see your colleagues. And that way, when you write an offer, you can say to me, hey, Malone, I don't know if you remember, but I met you last week at such and such a house and said, hi, I'm a new agent on, you know, Jim's team. I'm like, oh yeah, nice to meet you, because I know I'm going to have to deal with you, and it's nice to put a name to a face to a name. Mm-hmm. So I absolutely give that advice. The other piece of advice I give is, in your chosen market, know as much as you can about three different houses: the high-end, finished, ready-to-go house, the pretty well-priced, this would be a deal house, and the this is an opportunity to come in, spend some money, and I don't want to call it a flipper, but as close to a flipper house as you can get. I said, try and always have those three houses that meet those criteria. So now you walk into this restaurant with your mom, you're having lunch, and she introduces you to her friend from college who's with her husband, and she says, oh, Malone just got his real estate license, and the guy says, oh, I saw this house on Ocean View. It looks really great. It's completely finished. My wife and I are thinking, well, you know what? I know that house you're talking about, but I haven't been in that one. But, you know, there's one over on Mesa Boulevard that's just finished to the nines. I mean, it's got marble countertops, three bedrooms, 4.5 baths with an amazing backyard with a built-in jacuzzi. And because you know that house, right? Yeah. Or they say, oh, I'm always looking for a project. And you're like, oh, well, you know what? There's this great flipper house I'd love to show you. So if you have at least three you can talk about, you can demonstrate your depth of knowledge and not feel bad about admitting you don't know the details about their house they're asking you about, right?
Yeah.
Don't bullshit. Say, oh, I haven't been in that one, but I was in this other one that I think you might like. And, you know, I think that's the advice I would give.
I think that's great advice for your market too. I mean, I give a similar piece of advice with know the building. If I know 6 or 7 of those buildings, it gives me something to talk about in that range that they're talking about.
Yep.
That shows that I do this every day and I know the inventory. Cause if they say, oh, have you seen this one? And you shrug and say, no.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So what you're doing, that's exactly analogous. That's exactly the same thing, except in our case, it's single family homes, right?
Right. Right. Yeah.
No, I haven't seen the one on Ocean View Boulevard. And I'm thinking to myself, I didn't even know there was one on Ocean View Boulevard on the actives. You know, I have to go check that. But let me tell you about da, 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 da. That is absolutely. And you get to demonstrate some level of knowledge. People want to know something of value. And, you know, who cares if they end up hiring you as a realtor or not? It's good practice. And maybe they remember you. I have four clients that have all been referred to me by one guy I showed around 4 years ago who never bought a house.
Wow.
Right? And two of those four clients have referred me to other people.
Wow.
One guy.
That's great.
Yeah.
And you never even...
Showed him a house, a couple houses. He thought I was great. He has never gotten it around to buying something here. And he just sends me... He's a financial manager up in the Bay Area. And he's like, yep, Malone's your guy. And now his four friends... Like, in fact, one of those guys has bought and sold a couple of different houses. And he called me and he said, oh, so-and-so, you know, I just sold my company and so-and-so said I should give you a call.
So let's dig into that a little bit more. What do you think you did to that guy that made you so memorable to him? Or
I think I'm relatively personable and I'm pretty straightforward, right, about the quality of the house. And then this is, you know... In fact, I think I remember, because that house is back on, I waved them off of a house. It has a couple of vacant lots next to it. And at the time, they were owned by banks. And I said, okay, so this house is great, but on your left and your right, those two big beautiful vacant lots are buildable lots and they're owned by a bank. So who knows who they're going to sell it to and what amount they're going to sell it for. And it could be a fire sale. So you get somebody buying a lot that can't really afford to build a house of the same quality of your house. You know, if we knew it was a high-priced lot that was going to go to somebody, but we don't know. We don't know what's going to be built there. And it's going to be right there. I said, and the problem's going to be, it's going to be 16 months on the left side and then 2 months of quiet, and then they're going to go build on the other side. And there's another 16 okay. months, you know.
You instantly gained his trust there.
Yeah. And I was not doing it for any other purpose than because I was just doing my job, you know. I have another client who are fantastic friends of mine, and I showed them a property, and they called me 6 years later, 5 or 6 years later, and said, "Do you remember us?" And she has a distinctive accent because she's not from the United States. And I said, "Of course. How have you been?" She's like, "Well, we bought up in the Bay Area, but I have carried your card. And we've always said if we ever bought here again, we'd give you a call if you were still in business. So are you still in business?" And absolutely. You know, that was 5 or 6 years. So,
wow.
Yeah. So if that would be my other advice to new agents is, I think every conversation you have with a potential client should feel like a success, even if it doesn't lead to a sale, right? So that you're doing your job and you feel good that you've done your job for them. Even if at the end they say, "We can't," like I have these great clients I showed around for 6 months. We could find them nothing in their price point, and they just bought up in Danville, which is up near San Francisco. And my response, and they said, "We're done. We can't do this anymore. We're dying down here." I said, "No problem." And then they said, "Oh, we are in escrow." I'm like, "Fantastic. Send me the pictures, you know," and they're going to close, I think, next week. So I've looked at their house. Why wouldn't I be happy for them, right? So every conversation you should end and say, "Okay, I've done my job to the best of my ability for this client where they are right now." And maybe they call you 6 years from now. Yeah, mm-hmm. You just don't know.
And I'm curious, how many listings do you have on the market in that, you know, what does the inventory tend to be?
Right now, we just sold a couple. I've got 4,395,000 really, really, really neat house that we oversaw the redevelopment of to get it ready for the market. I've got one coming in a couple weeks at 3.5. Our market right now is constrained by lack of inventory, right? Mm. So, and there's a couple reasons for that. But because we have such limited inventory, we haven't seen the degradation of prices that a lot of places in the country have seen, right? So but it's more of a balanced market. For a long, long time, it was very much a seller's market. Sellers could dictate their price to some and terms. Now it's more balanced, but in a lot of places in the country, it's shifted to where buyers really, you know, have some more authority in what they're doing. And that really isn't happening here, partly because of lack of inventory. So why? So there's a few reasons. One is, I have a list right now of clients that have said to me, "Hey, Malone, if you can go find me a bigger house, a smaller house, a house with a better view, a house closer," you know, it depends on the client, right? But all these criteria, "if you can go find me that, I'll sell the one I'm in." Well, the lack of inventory makes it very hard to find that. And therefore, there isn't more inventory because my clients aren't listing their houses. So it becomes this, you know, the cogs have seized up, right?
Right.
So that's a huge factor around here. The other thing, and this is less significant here because we have so many cash buyers, but there are still a lot of folks who are in loans on their houses at 2.5% or 3%. Yeah. And you go show them a house and they're like, "I love the house, but I'm going to get a 6 and something loan on this. Why the hell would I do that?" And I have to say, "I don't know." You know, I think the golden handcuffs really are very significant when it comes to the lending environment. So a lot of the transactions or the listings we're seeing around at the moment are life event listings, right?
Yes. Mm.
So somebody has passed away, somebody's kids have moved out, somebody's kids want to move back in, they're retiring, they're moving somewhere else. Like maybe this is a second home and they're based in San Francisco and they just got transferred to Chicago and they don't want a second home in Carmel or Pebble Beach. So it's life event stuff. Whereas on a more normal market, fairly big percentage of sellers are elective, right? About a third of our market is people moving within the market. "I've owned a little cottage in Carmel. Now I'd like to own a bigger home in Pebble Beach. Oh, I really like living in Pebble Beach, but there's too much fog. Now I want to live out in Carmel Valley with a swimming pool," right? That population is not moving around because they can't find the place to go. And if they can, they feel like they're overpaying. you know, as you know, it's fun when you talk to somebody and they make this great seller argument about why their house should be worth this amount. You know, from 2 years ago, I should still get that number. And then you go look at a house and they're like, well, that's ridiculous. This seller's crazy. And I'm like, you realize that the argument we had this morning, you got to pick one. I don't care. Just pick one. And of course, I don't actually say that, but I have to say, okay, you know, their perspective is sort of like your perspective when we talk about selling your house.
I do say that. Yeah.
I know. I do. Yeah. I do. I say, you know, hey.
It's the one opportunity you have to, you know, because normally someone's on one side of the fence or the other when they're on, you know, and you say, well, I'd say it in the same way you said. I say, you know, the same way that you're feeling about the value of your house, the seller may be feeling theirs.
Possibly. Like you guys could go have beers together and agree, except when they found out that you were the buyer, you know. So it definitely, so that's a big part of what's going on. I think we are very much seized up. And if you look at the numbers of members of our local association, 41 agents had more than 2 sales in the first quarter. That's 3% of our total population of agents.
Okay? Wow.
Another 3% had 2 sales, 8.9% had 1 sale, and 84% of agents had no sales in the first quarter.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not a work harder problem, right? If there's no transactions, there are no transactions, or if there's so few transactions. Mm-hmm. So beating yourself up is counterproductive. I mean, work hard, but it isn't, I don't want to say it's not your fault, but it's not your fault. Right.
Yeah, it's not always. I mean, we have this joke. I don't know if you have the same one, but if you want business, go on vacation.
It is not a joke.
You know,
I swear to God. It's insane.
I've never been able to make sense of it either, but
Yeah. I'm trying to go out of town for a couple of weeks and I'm like, oh my God, I got all this stuff going on that wasn't going on 3 weeks ago. Yeah, it is. Wouldn't it be fun? It would be fun if we got like a dozen of us across the country to actually track that and see if we could get some sort of statistical and then figure out what the secret sauce is. I mean, are we putting something out in the universe when we're like, hey, I'm going on vacation, and then that prompts something to happen? I don't know.
I don't know, but it's certainly been true for me, and I've heard it from enough people that it's interesting.
It is definitely a mantra around here. We absolutely say that.
Yeah. First off, if listeners want to get in touch, particularly if they have, you know, someone in the area, buyer or seller referral, how would they get in touch with you?
Yeah. So my website is MaloneHodges.com and my email is Malone@MaloneHodges.com. And that's probably the easiest way to reach me. My cell phone's 831-601-4740.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, Malone, it's been so great having you on the show. I think we could have done this for hours, and I'd love to have you back on. So thanks so much for coming on the show. It's
been a pleasure. It was great fun. I totally enjoyed the conversation. I am going to send you a copy of the California Association Realtors contract, so you can check that out, and then you can send me some examples of some of your lawyer-generated language, and we'll decide who has a bigger challenge in their day-to-day life. But it's been great talking to you, And, you know, I do get to New York from time to time, so beer on me. And, of course, the invitation is always out there if you're headed this direction.
Okay, wonderful.
Great talking to you.
Thanks, Malone. Thanks for listening to the Top Broker Podcast. If you want to get in touch or suggest a guest for the show, email phil@topbrokerpodcast.com. And if you wouldn't mind doing a rating or a review for the show, I'd really appreciate it. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.